From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
At the beginning of 7 Seconds or Less, his new book about the Phoenix Suns, Jack McCallum discusses the anticipation he felt before the project began. He's not sure how it will go. I had never engaged in participatory journalism, he writes, unless you count having Shaquille O'Neal back his 350-pound ass into me to demonstrate how he doesn't commit offensive fouls. Participatory journalism turns out to include a seat at the end of the bench for the Suns' games and access to the locker room, coaches' meetings, and various other places frequented by Suns personnel. What McCallum discovers is that some of the preposterously well-compensated Phoenix players are suspicious, insecure, and brittle, while others are healthy, good-natured, and often pretty funny. Consider, for example, Steve Nash's reply when McCallum asked him why he didn't pay attention to Coach Mike D'Antoni's instructions at the end of a close game. "I couldn't hear him," said the point guard, "but I wasn't going to listen to him anyway." When I had the opportunity to talk about 7 Seconds or Less with Jack McCallum, I asked him how he had come to choose Phoenix as the team with which he'd be associated for the 2005-2006 NBA season.
Probably friendliness to reporters would be number one. The sports world has gotten different, Bill, in the million years that I've been covering it. And, you know, teams don't need the media that much anymore to sell tickets, which was the traditional sort of beck and call of public relations departments. So, you know, there's very few teams in sports that would have acceded to allowing a guy to hang around the whole year. And honestly, had the Phoenix Suns said no, I really don't think that I would have written any book.
At what point during your association with the Suns did you find yourself thinking, ah, yes, I have picked the right team to follow?
I think, Bill, it was probably early in January or late in December. I can't remember. I had started the project basically in training camp, which is October. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from my wife, who heretofore had been extremely disinterested in sports, which is probably why we're still together. And she said, "I stayed up watching the Suns last night. That Diaw's really going to be a player." And I said, "Wow." And I'm saying that, you know, honestly, seriously, because there's just something attractive about the team. I kind of knew it from the beginning, but this was sort of a really special season. I mean, they had one of their main players hurt, and they were integrating two or three new guys, including Boris Diaw, Raja Bell, both of whom turned out to be kind of cult stars in their own way. I was just so fortunate, because a lot of times in this business, you do not get the desired result, that's for sure.
You characterize Phoenix as, quote, the sporting world's answer to jazz. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that basketball, as you know, is sort of looked upon by the non-basketball-watching public as this kind of wild and wacky free-for-all. In point of fact, the NBA's problem is that it has been traditionally the antithesis of that. And we've talked about that a little bit before on the show, that there's too much defense, there's too much coach interference, there's too many set plays, there's not enough scoring. You know, exactly the kind of things that people believe to be the opposite. Well, the Suns came along and said, you know, we're going to try to get up a shot within 7 seconds of the shot clock, which accounts for the title of the book. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, we can get a good shot. Furthermore, we can be fundamental players doing that. Furthermore, we're going to commit fewer turnovers because we're throwing fewer passes. So they have kind of an improvisational style to their play, which actually is belied a little bit by the work the coaches do behind the scenes. But when they get out on the court, it is a little bit like a great jazz performance.
Why is it that the Suns can make that fast break style of play work while other teams, the coaches just say they're going to do it and they can't make it work?
Exactly. I mean, since the Suns have done this, since Mike D'Antoni came there 3 seasons ago now and announced they were going to do this, I've heard this from 100 coach, well, not 100 because there's not 100 teams in the league, but every coach, "Oh, my God, we want to play this way. Gee, we think it's great, but we don't have Steve Nash." So there's this kind of eternal polemic in the league whether Nash makes the Suns or whether the Suns make Nash. Obviously, the Suns would not be as good doing this without Steve Nash. However, it's hard to believe somewhere else there's not another guy that, had a coach been fully committed to that style, would be able to run and gun like the Phoenix Suns do.
Of course, the flip side of having Steve Nash on your team is other overly sensitive players may feel that they're not getting sufficient attention because Nash gets so much. One of the first observations in the book that surprised me was your contention that Sean Marion, certainly a star in his own right, quote, lives in a perpetual state of fear that he is being overlooked, under-respected, ignored, dissed, persecuted, singled out, patronized, whatever. Why is that?
Well, it's probably not because of his salary, because he makes about $15 million, which is more than Nash makes. Sean, you know, brings this upon himself. Within 5 minutes of any conversation with Sean Marion, I mean, you can be talking about the weather, and he will somehow bring it around to the fact that he is, you know, kind of tired about being the organization's eternal third wheel, that even when Stephon Marbury was there, that he was undervalued. And now that Steve has come, Steve's the MVP. Why aren't I the MVP? You know, and I put in the book that, you know, large salaries do not make you invulnerable to human frailties. And this is Sean's particular one. I mean, I don't know whether Shakespeare ever wrote a play where the fatal flaw was being sensitive to being overlooked. But it's not exactly hubris, you know, but it is this really peculiar thing that what he does doesn't show up in the box score. And to a certain extent, that's probably true. The number one thing being defense, where Steve Nash is a certainly average defender, maybe a little bit below average, and Sean has to guard a number of positions, sometimes point guard and sometimes big centers.
During a game in the playoff series between the Suns and the Lakers, Rajah Bell, playing for the Suns, of course, essentially tackles Kobe Bryant, playing for the Lakers. To nobody's surprise, Bell is subsequently suspended. There's some worry that he'll be suspended for more than one game. How did you approach asking Bell about that play?
With trepidation. I remember the day after Rajah did that, he comes into the gym and Steve Nash was down there, and Steve, you know, I talked about in the book, kind of greeted him like a rock star, and Rajah looks kind of abashed a little bit. You know, he doesn't know. He knows he's going to get his butt suspended, and it was a stupid play. And I go over and throw a couple lob balls at him, and I finally said to Rajah, man, what did you do that for? You know? And he had this great explanation. I still remember he said, first of all, he doesn't like Kobe Bryant. I mean, the word detest would not be too strong. But, you know, Rajah said, you know, I just looked at him and I was going, Rajah, all right, don't do it. Don't do it. You're going to do it. You're going to do it. Damn, you did it. You know, that he couldn't restrain himself. And, I mean, I talked in the book about Rajah being, you know, the nicest guy in the world, but having a true anger management problem, to which the coach at Boston University, as a matter of fact, when he was there, sent him to get anger management counseling when he was a sophomore. So, you know, maybe that's what he needs for his competitive edge. Maybe it's genetic, because Rajah told me he remembers going to his father's 50 and over national tournament games, and his father got thrown out of two 50 and over tournaments for fighting with an opponent. So Rajah kind of comes by it naturally.
Rajah Bell is not alone in his attitude towards Kobe Bryant, though. Were you surprised to learn how much genuine animosity some of the Suns and some players elsewhere feel towards him?
A little bit, but I sort of saw it during the year in my kind of, you know, I had to keep working at Sports Illustrated, and Kobe had scored 81 points in a game, as you remember, against Toronto. And I wrote a story about it, as well we should. And, I mean, the emails I got, you know, afterward were just kind of extraordinary. Like, I mean, they were all directed at Kobe the person. I remember even going on a show with Howard Kurtz, you know, the media critic, and saying, well, how can you glorify a guy like Kobe? I said, look, there's time to do delineations of Kobe's character and personality, and we can talk about that. He is arrogant. You know, I think that's his main problem. He can't figure out how to be one of the guys. Jordan's great talent, Michael Jordan's, was figuring out how to be one of the guys. Kobe can't seem to do that, and that has colored his perception in the eyes not only of the populace but also of many NBA players. And Kobe is a smart kid. He kind of knows that. But knowing it and being able to do something about it are two different things. And I really do think this year he is really starting to figure out how to do something about it.
You write that you went out of your way not to flaunt your access when other writers were present. And that was certainly thoughtful. But what did you learn as a constant presence with the Suns that you wouldn't have learned had you been a beat writer or just a guy doing another feature story for Sports Illustrated?
I wouldn't have thought much about, you know, the guys that are the third, the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth player on the roster with this eternal jostling to find their identity. You know, I wouldn't have had a good sense of that as I did hanging around with Raja and Eddie House and even Pat Burke, the 12th man on the team. That was one thing. Another thing would be how eternal this up and down rhythm of the season is, particularly among the coaching staff. They would lose a game on Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, I swear, in a coach's meeting, it would be, my God, we're never going to win another game. Mm-hmm. How are we going to do? What are we going to do? Then they'd win that night's game, and it would be, we're never going to lose again. It was up and down. It was up and down. It was taking care of little fires. Sean didn't get enough shots last game. How do we get him more shots? Raja was mad that he wasn't in on crunch time. How can we figure out how to play everybody? These a million questions. And one of the things I found out was the coaching staff that figures out which of these little questions to worry about and which ones do you have to table and not let it consume yourself or the team, they're going to be, by and large, the successful ones.
Last year, Phoenix made it to the conference championship series. You must have been rooting for them to make the finals, or did you not allow yourself to root?
Well, you know, the dirty little secret of sports writing is that you're rooting for your story, particularly in a magazine where you have a certain angle. Let's go back to, you know, 1992, let's say. And if I was assigned to write a story that Larry Bird was on his last legs and that he had gotten 8, 7, and 6 points in his last three games, and it's time for Larry to go, and I really believe that. I loved Larry Bird. I love watching him play. I still like talking to him when I see him. I think he was great. But in some small part of me would be rooting for my story, that if I went there that night, Larry would do badly. That's a terrible thing to say. So if I looked at this as a story, there is no doubt I was rooting for the Phoenix Suns. The longer they were playing, the better my book would be. The more they were winning, the happier they would be. The happier they would be, the more they would want to talk to me. So there was no doubt I was rooting for the story. But probably for the first time, a personal relationship to an extent that I had not known before really, you know, grew up between myself and the coaches. It just, you know, I was around them so much. They're great guys. They're about the same age as me. And we just kind of clicked. And that was a little bit hard, Bill. That's the first time I ever went back and really felt that I was not only writing about friends, but I was writing about friends, you know, in a really long format.
You point out in your epilogue that the cast of characters in Phoenix has changed considerably since last year. How do you like the Suns' chances this time around?
I still think, when I look at the league, that a team like the Dallas Mavericks and the San Antonio Spurs can still play volleyball up on the backboard, that the Suns don't have quite enough rebounding toughness and quite enough defensive stoppedness, which is not a word, I might add, but
it ought to be.
All right, well, let's make it one. That they don't have those periods of time when they can lock you down for 3 or 4 minutes. They're not a bad defensive team. I mean, they are not a horrible defensive team, but I don't think they're as good as the Mavericks defensively, and I don't think they're as good as the Spurs. And the Eastern Conference notwithstanding, I'm not sure what's even going on there between Detroit and Cleveland. I still personally put them as the third best team in the West, and if they're by any chance listening to this, they're going to give me some crap the next time I see them, but I hold to that position.
Jack McCallum is the author of 7 Seconds or Less, My Season on the Bench with the Runnin' and Gunnin' Phoenix Suns, published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City. Jack, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
My conversation with Jack McCallum will be featured on Saturday's show. I'll also be talking with analyst Pat Forty about the college basketball season, and we'll have a story about how the ski industry has been trying to manage without snow. The names of two athletes in the news this week, Barry Bonds and David Beckham, will surface at some point, I'm sure, and there are several football games to discuss as well. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the show at onlyagame.org.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 7-passenger MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.